You're listening to the Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In an age of rapidly expanding income inequality, people are figuring out ways to do more with less, invoking ideas of self-reliance and simplicity embodied by people like Thoreau, Gandhi, the Quakers, and the Amish. In The Unsettlers, In Search of the Good Life in Today's America, Mark Sundin follows three couples in Missouri, Michigan, and Montana who are living off the land while practicing their own versions of simple living. It's published by Riverhead Books, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Mark Sundin back to our show. Welcome back.
Thank you.
How would you describe the concept of simple living?
For these people, it's this idea of living in ethical resistance to what they see as an unjust state or an unfair economy, but doing that in a way that doesn't make them crazy, in a way that brings joy to their life.
How different is it than what survivalists do?
Well, survivalists who I met during my research, I felt they were really motivated by fear. They were awaiting the collapse so that they could then outlast it. And I started to consider, well, that to me is kind of a paranoid vision of the future. And I was interested in people who are either trying to prevent the collapse by changing the world, or in Detroit, people who are responding to the collapse.
How is simple living different from the local movement?
I would say the two things are pretty close. Local food is just sort of an appropriate technology to get food that doesn't impact the world in a terrible way. And of course, local economy is a way to not be dependent on the banks that seem to be destroying us and our freedoms.
But you also deal with some common myths about buying locally sourced food.
Yeah, I guess one of those myths is that you can buy your way into happiness. And, you know, part of the problem with local food is it can be quite expensive. And then you find yourself needing more money, and then you have to get another job. And then you're getting deeper into that cycle of earning and spending.
In the first part of the book, you highlight the Possibility Alliance, the PA, a radical back-to-the-land movement that was founded by Ethan and Sarah Hughes. Who are they?
Well, she was a classically trained opera singer who attended Grinnell College. He was a marine biologist and an outdoor educator, and they were out living in Oregon, homesteading, and they were kind of part of a environmental activism movement, marching in Seattle during the WTO. But eventually they decided they want to take it a step further, and they wanted to remove themselves from all industries that they found harmful. So they decided they weren't going to use any petroleum products or electricity. And that's how they found their way to an off-the-grid homestead in Missouri.
La Plata, Missouri. Well, sounds like they're doing a version of Amish life.
Absolutely. In fact, they chose La Plata, Missouri because there were Amish people there and they figured they could learn from them. They bought an old Amish farm. But, you know, what was interesting to me about them is they weren't raised Amish. They weren't even raised Christian, per se. But they have embraced that lifestyle.
And they've actually produced a mission statement?
Oh, yeah. To them, it's a movement to really change the world. They spent 2 years living on a Gandhian community in France, which was also off the grid. But it's not a sense of dropping out. It's rather sort of rehearsing, if you will, a way to make direct action, to use nonviolence to change the world.
And you said they don't use petroleum products because that causes pollution?
No, it's more like it causes violence. This is a Gandhian way of looking at nonviolence. If the petroleum industry is using war or displacement of indigenous people to get the oil, then my buying it is, in fact, financing that violence.
Well, what are the challenges of this kind of living? You have to do you still wind up going into town?
They do go into town on their bicycles, which is 6 miles to a tiny town and then 14 miles to the college town. And that can be prohibitive, especially now that they have two small children. But I guess there's two types of hardships. The first is the physical of you know, having to heat your house by chopping wood and putting it in the log stove, or having to heat water in order to bathe, having to milk the cows and work in the garden. But they really love that. That doesn't seem like a hardship.
You mentioned that many volunteers have spent weeks or months at the PA, but after almost a decade, only one other person has signed up to live that way full time. Has that been a source of stress for Ethan and Sarah?
It's been a disappointment because they get 1,500 visitors per year who just kind of gush and they say, this has been a life-changing experience. I love this place. I love what you stand for. But they don't want to take that step. But that step requires giving away all of your money.
Also, but also would require Ethan and Sarah to kind of tweak their concept, perhaps, or compromise some of their beliefs.
Yeah, they're absolutely dedicated to this, to Gandhian nonviolence, and they're not really willing to compromise.
And how did you feel when you spent time at the PA? Was it difficult?
It was. I mean, it was difficult just in the physical sense that it was really hot and there was no air conditioning or ice cubes. But it was also difficult to realize the degree to which I'd become dependent on technologies. For instance, the internet, and like how much time I spend feeling bad about myself, comparing myself to other people, thinking my career is a failure. And I sort of like pick at that scab online.
Well, let's see if your career is a failure. Mark Sundin is a contributing editor to Outside Magazine and a creative writing professor at Southern New Hampshire University. His latest book is The Unsettlers, In Search of the Good Life in Today's America, published by Riverhead. You also mentioned people like Wendell Berry and Scott Nearing, who have written books about early advocates of simple living. How did their experiences shape their messages?
Yeah, the Nearings and Wendell Berry are really the grandparents of this movement, and they've combined the sort of simplicity concept of working with your hands and doing work that makes you feel good and makes you feel like you've achieved something, combining that with this ethical boycott of the financial industry, the oil and gas industry, the industrial food industry.
You also profile Greg and Olivia, a couple who are running Brother Nature Produce in Detroit. But what's their story? How did they meet?
They met at a farmer's market. You know, what brought me to Detroit was interviewing all these preppers who were preparing for the collapse. And so I said, well, let me examine the collapse firsthand. And that's how I met
the collapse of Detroit, because it was declaring bankruptcy, or it declared bankruptcy.
Right, right. So Olivia grew up in Detroit. She's black, and her dad had kind of disappeared in the crack epidemic. And through her hard work and through her great mother, she got a scholarship to college. She came back to Detroit and had her dream job as a horticulturalist at the conservancy there on Belle Isle. And all this training she'd done to sort of get ahead, play by the rules, she just watched it crumble as the city went bankrupt.
Is the city encouraging locally sourced products as a result of the bankruptcy? Is it trying to reinvent itself?
The city is in such a mess that it's hard to tell what they're encouraging. They did recently allow people to buy vacant lots from the city specifically to farm on them. So I think they are moving in that direction.
Well, Detroit, of course, had a big inner city, but it also wealthier people lived in the suburbs. What place does the creation of the suburbs have in this narrative?
Well, the creation of the suburbs was a government subsidy which resulted in white flight, and it also resulted in the decimation of black neighborhoods. Specifically, freeways were built with tax dollars to ease the commute for the white folks, and meanwhile destroy the neighborhoods that the black folks have been building for decades.
Greg grew up the son of a Ford factory worker. Both of his parents were Ford factory workers?
His father and both of his great-grandfathers had worked for Ford.
But he became an anarchist punk rocker?
Yeah, he grew up in the suburbs.
How does he go from there, from being a would-be member of MC5 into living the simple life?
you know, as a teenager, he would come in from the suburbs to downtown Detroit, and he just loved the scene and the punk rock. And he, in his college years, actually founded a anarchist collective. And it was all about breaking down racism and sexism. And from there, he became a public school teacher for 15 years. And sort of as a final bit of disillusion with that, he told me that, he said, I used to think I could change the world through public education. Now I think I can do it through local
school. How much land do they have?
They have, they farm on a city block, which is about 14 vacant lots. And they've recently bought some more traditional farmland about 25 miles out of the city. And so they're now farming both of those lots.
Well, and I'm sure they're not bicycling. The third couple is Lucy and Steve Elliott from Victor, Montana. You spent time with them. How did they come to live in a teepee in a place like Victor, Montana?
Lucy had gone to graduate school in environmental studies at the University of Montana in the early 80s. And she became so frustrated with what she saw as a bunch of academics twiddling their thumbs that she dropped out of school and started to work on this organic farm where she met Steve, and they eventually became the owners of it.
And they seemed to be very idealistic but not dogmatic about how they would make a living and raise their family. Do all of these couples have guiding principles that they try to live by?
Absolutely. I mean, Steve and Lucy named one of their kids Wendell. That's how inspired by Wendell Berry they were in his vision of small-scale agriculture.
So but what differentiates them from the other two couples that you profile?
Really, the main thing is how long they've been at it. These other two couples have young children, whereas, and you never know what'll happen once those kids get into high school age or college age. Steve and Lucy have been doing this for 35 years. They had that first baby in the teepee in Montana, but now they've succeeded by even conventional standards.
I'm speaking with Mark Sundin. His book, The Unsettlers in Search of the Good Life in Today's America, it's published by Riverhead Books. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with Mark Sundin, a contributing editor to Outside Magazine and a creative writing professor at Southern New Hampshire University, author of a number of books. This, the one we're discussing, is The Unsettlers in Search of the Good Life in Today's America. It's published by Riverhead Books. We have people living near Detroit, but Detroit, which is not a typical city. But then we've been talking about Lucy and Steve Elliott, who live in Victor, Montana, which I assume is rather isolated area. And yet one of their children decided to go to Parsons School of Design here in Manhattan.
Yeah, he'd never been to New York, and he decided that this is what he wanted to do, was to be an artist. And I felt like it was almost like Steve and Lucy were being punished for their hubris, because they had raised their kids with so little money and with so little pop culture. And they'd kind of instilled in them this work ethic and this simplicity. And here he comes to New York.
And has he done okay? How has he survived without the skills that most Americans would have had?
He's done really well here. But there's a funny story that he showed up and he picked up a key to an apartment he had found on a Craigslist. And he got there and he realized he had never in his life used a key to open a door. And then the key broke off. In the lock, so he was stuck.
You describe Lucy and Steve Elliott as butting up against big organic. What's that?
Well, they were doing organic before it had that name. This was in the early 80s. They were the pioneers. And then when organic certification came along, they started to get certified. And after 15, 20 years of that, they have this libertarian streak. And they said, you know, we don't need the government coming in here and looking at our stuff and giving us a gold seal of approval. We're just going to self-regulate. And they changed the name from organic to homegrown.
Mm. And has that been okay for them?
It's been great. The stores that they supply to have such trust in them that they're okay with it. And they've managed to just not have to be under the yoke of that government regulation.
You write that places like Brooklyn, Portland, and Missoula have, now that they've been discovered as cool, have become prohibitively expensive places to live. Do you see particular regions or cities in America that are on the cusp of being discovered like that?
Well, yeah, I mean, all through the Midwest and the West, you know, all the college towns have sort of been insulated against the recession. And as a result, these kind of farmers markets and farm-to-table stuff is popping up. And it's getting too expensive to be a farmer anymore.
How is all of this different from the Back to the Land movement that was in the 60s?
I mean, that's where it started, has the same ideals. I think what's different to me is it doesn't feel like these people are dropping out. It feels like these people are very engaged with what they see as society's biggest failings, and they're trying to fix them.
But they are dropping out to some degree if they're living in isolated places.
Well, sure, but you know, the farm in Victor, Montana is only 30 miles from Missoula, so they have a market to sell to that close. And of course, Detroit is not the middle of nowhere.
You also discuss your desire to live simpler and your discussions with your wife on where you'd both like to live and what kind of life you envision. Can you tell us about those talks?
Sure. I mean, you start to want to change one thing in your life. It's like pulling a thread and it comes apart. For me, I was so angry about the banks, and then I found myself, you know, every month writing a mortgage check to Bank of America. But to change that was going to we'd have to reevaluate our whole life. So at this point, my wife's in graduate school, so we're kind of in a holding pattern, but we do have that acre of land out in Utah. Maybe we'll end up there.
Well, this is not just a commitment of one person. If we're talking about married couples or couples, then two people have to agree to an awful lot of things, and that can be kind of difficult.
Yeah, and as it turned out, I got married during the period of writing this book. And this book is about people who have volunteered to embrace limitations instead of try to get everything. And they found a deeper abundance, and that's kind of how I see marriage.
Did you learn anything from these couples that you can apply to your own life?
Yeah, I think that's it right there is, you know, we have a society that encourages us to gratify every desire. And if you can think of something you want, we'll sell it to you. And these people have opted out of that.
Would you have to come up with a fourth way, or is one of these couples kind of a role model?
Well, all of these people have chosen to do something that they absolutely love. They're not wearing a hair shirt and suffering. And I don't really love farming the way they do, but I do feel like I've been so lucky to find work that I do love, which is writing, and, you know, more or less make a living at it.
These couples are all producing something, so this is kind of a return to the way things used to be. You settled down on the land, you grew things, or you made something by hand, sold it, and that paid for the rest of the other necessities of life.
Yeah, and with the decline of, you know, family farms and manufacturing and the ascent of the so-called information economy, I think a lot of us sit at a screen all day and wonder what we've achieved at the end of the day.
You'd have to give up teaching if you did this.
That's true. Mm-hmm. And again, I think I'm better at teaching than I am at farming. So,
and would you stay with the Outside magazine?
I think I would. I mean, I think that I have more to offer as a writer than I do as a farmer.
Just one thing. Often in these kind of utopian approaches, there's been a religious aspect. Does that play a part in the lives of these couples?
In some, but not all. Ethan and Sarah are Quakers, so they've really embraced that simplicity and that kind of, I would call, radical Christianity. And they're big disciples of Gandhi. But it's not requirement.
Mark Sundin, the book, The Unsettlers in Search of the Good Life in Today's America, is published by Riverhead Books. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thanks for having me.